cancer moms have lots to offer. Like, you know, it's fine. I don't think that it's saying anything about my parenting, because there are things that I do that she doesn't. We all have our positive and negatives. And I think instead of seeing those positives as in a reflection of how we're doing or not doing, I think we should be seeing it as just like another great thing that a person brings to the table for the friendship.
You'll hear from women, leaders, and mothers. We're holding hands as we move through life's greatest transitions. Join us for The Rising.
You're going to love hearing from Ariana today. She sent me a copy of her book and I finished it in two sittings, which if you have small children is nearly impossible to do, but I was completely hooked. So she's so much fun to follow on Instagram if you haven't already. Head to the show notes just right now. Go ahead, give her a follow as you listen to this. We talk on writing a book for the first half of our conversation and what that process looked like for her, advice that she gives for someone who really loves writing and sees themselves writing a book one day. And then we dive into topics around shame as a mom and why, rather than judging one another, we can be gathering together to find other moms who have strengths that we may not yet possess. She is very insightful, and whether or not you have children, I know you're going to enjoy her stories. I think so many people have the desire to write a book. Right. So my biggest question is, did you always want to write a book and then this became the topic, or did you feel that this book almost wrote itself with all of your experiences?
No, I definitely have always wanted to write a book. I've been writing since I was like 5. So it's always been, I want to write a book, but I actually always used to write fiction. And then as I started getting more and more involved with working with moms and with, you know, kind of talking them through, being a mom and trying to be a mom with less shame, it just fell on me one day that I was like, this is what I want to write about. I want to write about this in particular. Yeah. To be fair, the decision to finally sit down and write a book did not come to me until 2018. Like, I have been sitting, like, I'll just suddenly get hit with inspiration and sit down and write a book, but like, or sit down and write like a story. But once I would get about like a third of the way through, I would realize that there was like a plot point that didn't make sense or something. I'd be like, I give up, you know, and just like toss it to the side. So I had like so many story ideas that were started and never finished. But really the precipitating moment was my grandmother passed in 2018, and I was very close with her. And I remember thinking, you know, shortly before she passed, she told my mother that she had done everything she wanted to do and that she was ready to go. And I remember thinking, A, I want to be able to say that when it's time for me to go. And B, I know that she would have loved to have seen my name on something. Yeah. And so I said, you know, I'm gonna sit down and this is gonna be for her. I'm gonna force myself through writing this book. And yeah, that was kind of what pushed me to do it. So in answer to your question, it was kind of a both thing. Like, I've always written and I've always wanted to write, but this sort of fell together. It wasn't like I have always wanted to write a book on not being a shameful parent.
Right. Well, I think that can kind of like writing, because I don't do any writing like professionally, but journaling I've done almost every day since I was really young as well. And a lot of times it seems to be that you can be writing something and you think it's going in one direction, especially if you're writing nonfiction, and then you start heading in a totally different direction. You're like, wow, I didn't actually know that I thought that. So I started getting pen to paper.
Right. Right. It's cathartic. It's very cathartic. Even when you're not writing about what is bothering you necessarily, there's something very cathartic about being able to sit down and take those emotions and wrap them up in words, even if they're not the words you want to say.
Right.
Yeah.
What would you, for anyone who's listening who does have that desire to write a book, but just maybe doesn't feel like they have the exact subject matter that they want to speak on, what would you say is a good either starting point for a book, or how could you almost like use your creativity in that way without feeling the pressure to create this final project?
So I can only say what worked for me, but I cannot speak highly enough of NaNoWriMo. Some people don't know what that is. That is National Novel Writing Month. It starts November 1st, and from November 1st to November 30th, you are challenged with sitting down and writing every day until you reach 50,000 words at the end of the month. You are not expected to have written your final project. Mm-hmm. You are not expected to read back and edit. You are not expected to write the next great American novel. You are just expected to have a first draft down on paper, 50,000 words, by the end of November.
Yeah.
And that's what I use to get myself started, because I had the idea in about September or October. And I told myself, okay, what I'm going to do is I'm going to use something that will force me to actually sit down and write. Mm-hmm. And I am actually not a write every day kind of person. If I force myself to write when I am not feeling the words, so to speak, it doesn't come out very good. And almost everything I write in that moment winds up getting deleted. But it had been a while since I had sat down to write anything for a long time. And I always use this metaphor of like an old tap that hasn't been used in a really long time. Mm-hmm. It basically helped me run the tap so that all of the rusty gunk came out first.
Yeah.
And by the end of the month, I was getting clear water. So it's really, really good for just kind of working yourself into a habit, because the saying, right, is that it takes 30 days to build a habit. Mm-hmm. And so those 30 days, just writing every day, I forced myself, I'm not a morning person at all, but the best time that I could get to write was anywhere between 5:30 and 6:30 in the morning. Yeah. And I would force myself to write for an hour every morning, no matter what. It was an hour, and I was writing whatever came to my head. Sometimes it was just free writing. Sometimes I had an idea of what I wanted to say. And I am the kind of person who I knew that if I read back and saw that I had made a mistake, I would give up. So I didn't read back, which felt horribly uncomfortable.
Yeah.
But by the end of those 30 days, using that concept, writing became a habit. And so then by the end of November, it was like I felt the need to write every day by then. And so then it was kind of a point of, you know, I was able to kind of step back and say, okay, when I'm not feeling open to writing, I can give myself a couple of days rest. And I would give myself a specific time I had to come back. Like if on a Monday I didn't feel it, I'd be like, okay, but I have to be back by Wednesday to try again. And just giving yourself that first push, NaNoWriMo is amazing, just because they also give you like a word count progress bar, which is great for me, because then you can see, you know, how far you are to your goal.
Mm-hmm.
But just doing stuff like that kind of gives you that incentive. Eventually, once you have done those 30 days, you will find that you are driven to keep going, because then at that point, it is kind of like you've exercised an old muscle and you've built up that habit.
Yeah, I love that. And I like having that external accountability for a lot of things too. I notice that with myself, if I have a project I really want to work on but have not set a deadline that I've actually told people about, mm-hmm. then you could push the deadline as long as you want, right? So like you said, saying I'll come back on Wednesday, if you told yourself, you know, okay, I'm going to come back when I feel that I'm ready, that could be weeks and weeks. And like you said, then you're not exercising those muscles, and that can turn into years and years.
Exactly. So it's just kind of one of those things where, you know, if you are going to give yourself that time, just make sure that you are setting specific time You know, that you're not saying, okay, well, I'll come back to this when I feel inspired, because God knows when that is. And sometimes that inspiration is going to be awoken by you starting to write. And I've had that happen before, writing articles and things like that, where I start out and it kind of feels like I'm limping along, and then maybe about 5 minutes in, I notice that like my fingers are flying and the ideas are coming. And, you know, one thing that I did learn through this whole process that's very, very important, and it sounds super elementary, but we forget, is that the first draft is not meant to be good at all. It's not meant to be anywhere near close to what you're going to finish with.
Yeah.
In fact, my entire first draft, first off, was only about 100 pages. And it was terrible. It was absolutely awful. And I'm pretty sure that, except for maybe a couple of things, I scrapped that entire first draft. But it was the first step on the way to my second draft,
right,
which was where I found the 4 paragraphs, maybe, of passage that I liked so much that I said, I want my entire book to sound like this 4 paragraph passage.
Yeah.
And that was, you know, what built the book in general. So you kind of need that terrible first draft to help you at least have an idea of where you're going after. So I think, you know, some of us sometimes feel super pressured and scared when we start, just because we're like, oh, this first draft is going to be complete crap. Yeah. And without, you know, we don't remember the fact that the first draft is supposed to be crap. It's supposed to be terrible.
Right.
So you're doing the right thing. You're actually on the right path if your first draft sounds terrible.
That's a good like point to remember. Everyone can walk away with that today, if nothing else.
Exactly. Your first draft is meant to be crap. Exactly. Yes.
Okay. So this book, I know there are a lot of books on parenting. And I'm not blowing smoke. This one is like the first one I read that I just felt completely understood by. And first of all, the title, Shame on You, Big Truths from a Bad Mom, you know, very catchy.
Aw, I'm so glad.
And I know.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. And I know we'll talk about shame a lot, but even just that word shame, or like the phrase shame on you, caught my attention, because I feel that, you know, no matter how confident you become as a mom, that is always underlying in some way, shape, or form. So I was curious to dig into that. And you said, you know, you could talk about guilt and shame for days, but I wondered if you'd be willing to share like some of the worst feelings you've had and kind of how you were able to overcome those and move through those around guilt and shame as a mother.
I mean, you know, the hard part about shame is that if you're going to feel it no matter what. I think I even say this in the book, that I never tell anybody not to feel guilty, because guilt is natural. You can't stop yourself from feeling guilty or ashamed. And in fact, probably one of my biggest pet peeves is when I say that I feel guilty about something and someone says, don't feel guilty. Like, you can't, that's like telling somebody not to feel sad or not to feel happy or not to, you know, find something funny. That's just not going to happen. So instead of telling myself not to feel ashamed or not to feel guilty, I tend to allow myself to feel it, and then I analyze it. You know, to give a very simple example, this is not my worst shame, but it's just an example before we get into that. You know, say that I am trying to do something and my son continues to keep coming in interrupting me. And it happens over and over again to the point where I snap. Mm-hmm. And I snap at him and he looks like his feelings are hurt. And immediately I feel this shame and this guilt of like, wow, you know, I just yelled at this small child and I am working instead of hanging out with him, and he just wants to be around me. And I'm, you know, I can do one of two things. I can either go down this dark spiral where I tell myself that I'm a terrible mother and that I should be paying attention to him and that I'm horrible for working and yelling at him. Or what I can do is I can analyze it and I can say, well, am I doing anything wrong by working? Well, no, I'm not.
Right.
I was probably wrong to snap at him in the way that I did, but it's completely understandable that I got to that point because he would not leave me alone. Where can I go from here? And then, you know, at that point, instead of it turning into me just self-flagellating because I'm upset or because he's upset and I feel like I should be, it turns into a more logical understanding of the situation and of myself and coming up with a solution.
Yeah.
So I learned this really by screwing up a lot. Like, you're going to screw up so much. That's just parenting in general. And, you know, probably the worst for me, I remember, was this one night where I was, because there are a couple in the book, but one that's not in the book is there was a night where my son had to go to the bathroom. It was, I want to say maybe 1 o'clock in the morning. We were staying at a family member's house. I take him to the bathroom. After he finishes in the bathroom, he starts screeching, like screaming because he's upset at me about something. And I kept telling him to be quiet and he wouldn't be quiet. And he was just screaming. I was afraid he was going to wake up the whole house. I wound up kind of putting my hand over his mouth and taking him outside and closing the door, and he's screaming and, you know, I'm afraid he's going to wake up the whole neighborhood or somebody's going to look out the window and like think I'm abusing this kid. And I remember that I like grabbed him and I sat him down and I just started, I didn't yell because I was afraid to yell, but I was like super scary, gritted teeth, just like, be quiet. Why won't you be quiet? You know, which was making him cry harder. And finally, he calms down. And I remember thinking to myself, I did not handle that well. I was mean, you know, he was probably upset about something that I should have tried to talk him through. And I felt extremely guilty. And I remember I felt super ashamed, and I felt ashamed when I woke up in the morning. And at the time, I didn't have the tools to be able to look at that shame and to look at that guilt. So I was just under the impression that I was a bad mom and that I had been mean to him and that, you know, he's going to grow up to hate me someday. And it took me a while to finally, you know, as I was kind of doing all this self-work later, to look back on that day and realize that while I didn't handle it well, there were a few things that were at least understandable, if not in my favor. In that situation, one, it was 1 o'clock in the morning and I was exhausted. Two, we had been traveling together for about a week with a newborn and a 2-year-old, which is very difficult.
Yes.
And three, there was definitely this understandable level of hysteria kind of bubbling up in me because I did not know what he was crying about. And it's very, very hard, just from a completely objective standpoint, to listen to somebody screaming and have absolutely no idea how to stop them from screaming because you don't know what they're screaming about.
Yep.
And add into that that you're tired, add into that that you don't want to wake up anybody else, and you kind of have this cocktail that turns into, instead of a fact-finding mission, turns into just this desperate, like, would you please just stop? I need you to just stop screaming.
Yeah.
And so after realizing that, and then also kind of realizing later that I was still the one that hugged him when he had a tantrum a day later, that I'm still the one who supports him in a lot of different things, and that we both kind of go through our times of being sick of each other. It's not just me being sick of his behavior sometimes. I was able to move beyond being ashamed of that and realizing that we're just not going to do things right all the time.
Right.
And that I can't hold myself to this ridiculous expectation of being perfect when I wasn't perfect before I had a kid. None of us were. And so having a kid and suddenly expecting ourselves to be perfect is just setting ourselves up for disappointment and, well, a lot of shame.
Yeah. Well, and I think, I mean, the opposite of having those big emotions around children, because it's very human, the opposite to me feels like being very stoic and almost seeming apathetic to children. And that, I don't think, would teach them anything about their own emotions either. And if you see an adult who is just always so steady, you start to keep your own emotions in too. It was just say it's hard when they're little because they do see you in a different light than when, you know, your child is 16 or when your child is 20 and sees you as a real person. But I think it's just that continuation of how do you, like you said, how do you come back afterward? How do you handle it? Talk through it? How do you move from it?
Right. And that is such a nuanced game. It really is. Which makes sense when you think about it. Because one thing that has really killed me about this whole thing is the more I have thought about the expectations that we are given by society and by each other, I'm just amazed that we expect so much when we are literally raising another human being.
Yeah.
Which means that we are raising a complex organism that has its own thoughts, feelings, emotions, and soul. And yet we are expected to somehow handle this in some sort of one-size-fits-all attitude, like it's like a hermit crab or something that's like not as complex. And your children are hugely complex. We are complex creatures. We're basically walking computers in a meat suit. And it's really bizarre to expect us to just be able to raise these kids without screwing up or without having to navigate some pretty hairy and very nuanced and weird situations. It's impossible to expect us to do perfectly with that much kind of stacked against us when you think about it. So the most that you can do in those situations is you're going to know your kid and you're going to have a pretty good idea of how they can be spoken to, and you're not always going to get it right. That's the hard part. And sometimes you go, what worked on Tuesday might not work on Thursday. That's also the hard part because things change, kids change. And it's something that's so fraught with guilt, but it's not really our fault. It's just kind of the situation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Now, so we talk about shame too. One of the things that really stuck out in your book to me is how you talk about other moms shaming moms. And something that I have always said and thought is that we really are not being shamed by other people. We're just putting that shame on ourselves. We just say like it's coming from other people, but really, you know, we stack that on ourselves and then say like, oh, she was mom shaming me, say maybe because she was breastfeeding and I'm bottle feeding. But I loved where you talked in your book, and I'm not going to read the whole thing because I want people to read the whole thing, but you talked about the hot mess mom. So give us a quick little descriptor of what that means, hot mess mom.
Hot mess moms, they are my people. Yeah. I am in the hot mess mom village. We are people who are just kind of blindly making our way through. Generally, we may have it really deep down inside that we want to do our hair and makeup every day, or, you know, take the time to actually put on pants instead of leggings, but it's just not going to happen. We, you know, at least I know I tend to swear in front of my children without generally meaning to. You're not really a domestic goddess. You've got a lot of things that you are good at, but cleaning the house before it looks like it was hit by a tornado may not be your strongest suit. And really, you know, you might have like 9,000 Pinterest boards full of things that you'd like to do, but you also just can't get up the energy to do any of them.
And
you're addicted to caffeine, don't drink enough water, and probably deal with anxiety at some point. So that's a hot mess mom in a nutshell.
Yes, there you go. So very relatable. But now you describe that in your book, but then the part that I love is how you talk about that a lot of women have created these communities basically based on that, saying like, you don't have to be perfect. You can, you know, show up in this messy way and still be a wonderful mom. And I actually mm-hmm. had a woman on the podcast, her tagline is like ditching the pressure to be Pinterest perfect, which I love. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But then what you've noticed happening is that when we see ourselves that way, as like, you know, it's okay that we're a hot mess, we tend to have a little judgment on moms who have it all together, or seem to, mm-hmm. right? In different ways.
Right. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And I love the part in your book, you said, so you said, I've seen groups of women sneer at someone who was kind just because they showed up in Louboutin heels to play dates. And you've seen women excluded for feeding their children organic food, not because they were a pain in the ass or pushy about it, simply because they made it all themselves. And I noticed myself, right, even doing that. It's like mm-hmm. the things that you feel you should be doing, mm-hmm. which, you know, you're kind of putting on yourself when you see someone else doing them and you don't feel that you are at that level in that particular way as a mother, that shame just starts to pile and pile.
We've really kind of fallen in of what our parenthood should be by what other people are doing. And yeah. that's where that comes from, because we get so annoyed, right? Because we'll say, hey, am I supposed to be feeding my child this food that I made myself? Like, is that what I'm supposed to be doing? And then what we do is we automatically roll that up in a ball and toss it back as, well, no, you're just setting up an unrealistic expectation for what parenting is, or you're trying too hard.
Right.
And that's not fair either. You don't get to say, well, I feed my children goldfish and peanut butter and deli crackers, and therefore that's what you should be feeding your child so that it matches what I am doing in my parenthood journey, so that I can prove that I'm doing it the right way.
Yeah.
No, we don't exist to prove things to one another. And that's kind of a frustration that I have seen. Just like kind of across the board, but I have noticed that the Pinterest perfect moms, so to speak, are getting backlash, where they are getting crap from, you know, people who are not quite so perfect, saying, oh, well, look at you trying so hard, look at you being fake. And it's like, you don't get to call people fake. That's messed up.
Yeah. Like, that's the funny thing is, like, I think a lot of the times I'm like, no, they're not fake. They're just like really, really good at birthday parties.
Like, exactly. Like, maybe that is their joy. Like, maybe yeah. they enjoy throwing really over the top birthday parties. And here's the thing too, and I've brought this up to people before, even if they're pretending, right? Even if their life is more like yours, social media, we're in a social media age. There's no getting away from it. It's pretty much part of everyday life.
Yeah.
But social media has led us to believe that we are entitled to parts of people's lives that we would not have been entitled to before.
Right.
Like, you know, if we didn't have, even back in the days of MySpace, okay, I mean, I'm dating myself here, but even back in those days, if somebody walked out looking picture perfect all the time, we would not have been like, ooh, there goes Janet walking out there looking picture perfect. Why doesn't she walk out in sweats sometimes to prove to us that she's just like the rest of us?
Yeah.
We wouldn't have done that, because we wouldn't have felt that we were entitled to that part of their lives. Mm-hmm. But now that we are kind of using Instagram, especially, but like Instagram, Facebook, we're using all of these things to document our lives, people feel like they are owed a chance to see the negative parts of your life. Mm-hmm. And nobody owes us that. So if your neighbor is constantly posting photos of her kids smiling, even though they've cried all day, that's really her prerogative.
Right.
And we shouldn't be telling her that she owes us photos of her kids crying because we need to feel better about our own kids crying. Like, that's not her job.
Yeah. That, oh yeah, I love that. Well, and I remember talking to I think my sisters about this, is that like seeing moms who have like their hair done and their makeup done, when I, you know, if I'm like going to a play date or something or dropping the kids off at daycare, it's like my immediate thought is like, I have to make friends with her because I want to learn how to do my hair and makeup because I don't even know. It's like, I'm not even mad. I just want that so bad.
I just need her to teach me her ways.
Yeah. And I have to read one more short paragraph from this chapter of the book I loved. It says, so it's talking about not making judgments off of what people are doing. You want to make your judgments based off of personality quirks rather than envy and insecurity. And you say, besides, you're telling me that you don't want to make friends with someone who fresh bakes shit for her kids all the time. I have one of those friends now. Shout out to your friend Jen. Then she gets up at like 4 a.m., bakes cookies, cakes, and pie. I don't know about you, but a friend who makes pie is going to have a lot of extra pie. And guess who gets that pie? Me. I'm not too proud of pie or cake or any baked goods, really.
It is true. I do get her run-ups of pie and cookies quite often. And it is not a bad deal. So if that's what she wants to spend her time doing, I am down for that, okay? Because there is, I mean, obviously I love her as a person too, and she's super supportive and sweet. Like, I don't want to make it sound like I'm only hanging out with her, you know, because she gives me sugary baked goods. But, like, I always just thought that that was kind of weird that people would sit there and be like, oh, you know, Pinterest moms. And it's like, listen, Pinterest moms have lots to offer. Like, you know, it's fine. I don't think that it's saying anything about my parenting, because there are things that I do that she doesn't. We all have our positives and negatives. And I think instead of seeing those positives as in a reflection of how we're doing or not doing, I think we should be seeing it as just like another great thing that a person brings to the table for the friendship.
Yeah, absolutely. And then we do tend to like box ourselves in, right? To say like that, yeah, we're being a good or a bad mom, when there are just hundreds of things that go into being a mom, and you need those friends who have the strengths you don't have so that you can say, hey, I really don't know what I'm doing with this whole potty training thing. You seem to be a pro, you know, I'll trade you for some pie. And you can tell.
Exactly. By the way, I will totally take a trade in pie. I'm not lying. I will do a favor for pie.
Yeah. Okay, so I want to kind of switch gears here. You tell a story in chapter 4 about Jenna Dewan. So I know you talked about you don't just love her because she got to be married to Channing Tatum, but that she was posting a photo in the postpartum stage, and that she was getting a lot of backlash with the way she was presenting herself. Mm-hmm. So I was curious about your thoughts on why society might be so uncomfortable with mothers being proud of their bodies or feeling sexy after they've had a baby. What do you see happening?
We connect mothers, most are going to be our own parents. And nobody wants to think that our own parents doing a horizontal mom role. Like, that's true. We don't want to think about that. So to us, our mother always just existed, you know, to wipe our faces with spit and to put us to bed, you know, and to take care of us when we were sick. They were these sexless, harmless people who existed purely to take care of children and were done with the whole sexual part of their lives.
Yeah.
So the idea of a mom, unless you're in it, obviously, but even for some people who are moms, now that I think about it, the idea of a mother still being a sexual being in any shape, way, or form kind of grosses people out, I think, because they think, ew, so that would mean my mom was doing that stuff. And by the way, sorry to scar anybody out there, but your mom was totally still doing stuff. Like, whether with someone else or to herself, she totally was. So sorry. But, you know, we don't want to believe that. We don't think about that. So really, there's this whole feminism with parenthood in general. We really just feel that once a mother becomes a mother, her body, her parenting, her mindset, it suddenly belongs to the public. We suddenly feel like, you know, it starts pretty early, really. When we get pregnant, people want to touch our stomach without asking.
Yep.
You know, suddenly the baby and the mother and her body becomes everybody else's opinion, and it becomes everybody else's property. And so the moment that you start showing it off, people start saying, oh, well, you're a mother. You're a mother now. You're supposed to be, you know, hiding yourself behind a burlap sack in a corner somewhere.
Yeah.
Instead of realizing that, you know, the body belongs to the mother. It has always belonged to the mother. That is the mother's body. And she is proud of it. And she is allowed to be proud of it. And, you know, just because you have decided that her body and her parenting belongs to you now, that's not true.
Right.
And so I think put those two things together even, and you have people who feel affronted because they feel like you are putting their property on an inappropriate display that reminds them that their parents were people once too.
Yeah.
And obviously there's probably some envy there, right? Like, I think that some people also maybe may not feel so comfortable with themselves in that way. And again, going right back to what we were talking about before, they decide that it reflects badly on them somehow. And so they decide that the best way to make themselves feel better is to say that it's her fault for daring to be proud of her own body, instead of, you know, looking within and realizing that maybe this is something that they need to work on themselves to be happy.
Yeah. Absolutely. And I think we feel like we have to give this explanation too. Like, I am a very tiny person, just like my stature. I'm just like 5 feet tall, very tiny. And I took a photo of myself like really soon after my second baby was born. And so, you know, I still had like my cute little postpartum pooch going on and lots of extra skin and, you know, just all of that. And it felt like I wanted to share this photo because it was this gorgeous photo of me and my daughter, but I was at the pool and I was in a two-piece suit, and I felt like I had to give this lengthy explanation about like how much I love my body and all the wonderful things it's done. And it was like this conflict in my mind, and I never put it anywhere because I felt like I just want to post this photo because I think it's cute. But it was like all of these layers of like, do I feel okay about how my body looks? Will people make a comment? What I've noticed that a lot of people do is when they see a photo that they deem to be not perfect, they'll say something like, oh, you're so brave for sharing this photo, which is like a really odd way.
Yeah, it's like, thanks, I think.
Yeah, like I would never want to be seen like this, but I'm proud of you for it.
Oh my gosh, you're so brave for looking like you. How dare you?
Yeah. And it's a hard thing too, because there's that like you said, where you're not going to see everyone's full life on display. I mean, even people who are like intentionally being transparent online. But then we have all these stipulations, right? So we're like, okay, we want to see all facets of a person. But then when a mother is showing people that like, yeah, I still, you know, feel sexy and I still feel confident in myself, then it's like, ooh, that's upsetting to me. I don't want to see that specifically. And
yeah. Yeah, absolutely. There is this attitude of like, well, why do I have to see this? And it's like, I mean, I don't know. There really shouldn't be a change, but there is like this huge change in the way people look at moms just in general once they become moms, and go back on how proud of yourself you're supposed to be. And you know, like I said, I touched on it a little bit, people don't tend to like it when women are proud of themselves anyway most of the time. All it takes is like a quick search through social media to see how many times people will talk shit about a woman who, you know, takes a lot of selfies, and they'll say things like, wow, she really must want attention, or wow, she must, you know, she really just, obviously she just needs attention all the time. Wow, why does she only take photos of herself? And it's like, I don't know, maybe she thinks she's cute. Like, why is that a bad thing?
But also, like, of course she needs attention, because we all need attention because we're human beings, but I think people around needing attention and connection. It's like,
yeah, like, there's nothing wrong with wanting to be, there's nothing wrong with wanting to get attention or wanting validation either. I think that we all need validation, and there's nothing wrong with that. That's we're allowed to feel like, you know, I don't feel very valid right now. I want people to tell me that I'm pretty, or that I'm, you know, smart, or that there's nothing wrong with that. And I think for some reason we have made it into a dirty word, and it's very weird to expect that from people.
Well, I just thank you so much for doing this. I just feel so honored to have already read through your book. I want you to let everybody know where they can find it.
So it is available on Amazon as either a Kindle or print version. And you can get it there, and you can get it literally anywhere that in country that anybody has Amazon. So super, super easy to order.
Amazing.
And all you have to do is search it by, you can search it by my name or book title, which is Shame on You, Big Truths from a Bad Mom.
Perfect. And we'll put a really easy Amazon link in the show notes as well. And I just want to let everyone know that when you get this book, you are going to go through it so quickly. It's like just the most fun thing to read. So I know everybody.
Thank you.
Yeah. Have you reread, like, when you've completely finished it and it's been published, have you sit down to read it, or you're just like, it's out there, it's good?
I pretty much had to do that. Because I am one of those people that once it's out there, if I sit down and look at it long enough, I will turn it into half of the time. Like, when I wrote the book, I was like, everybody's going to think that I'm trying way too hard. Like, nobody is going to find this funny at all, but I'm just going to put it out there. And I've had so many people write me and be like, I just read the first like 6 pages and it cracked me up. Like, I've been laughing nonstop since the book started. Like, and I'm sitting there going, really? Okay, that's cool. Cause I tried to read over it, and I read over it like God knows how many times. And there weren't really any times that I sat there and was like, this is hilarious. So I just don't bother to read it, because I know that my response just isn't going to be the same as everybody else's. But.
No, that's a very good point. I really do the same thing even with this podcast. Like, once I'm done editing it, I couldn't listen to myself speak for another whole hour.
I feel that.
No worries if you don't listen to this either.
Oh, I will totally. I'm totally going to tell everybody about it. No worries.
Well, thank you so much. This is a lot of fun. And as I said, I really enjoyed the book. So I'm going to be pushing for everyone to read it so that I can talk to them about it.
Oh, yay. And I'm so glad you enjoyed it. Seriously, that means so much.
Yeah.